now. Detonate the reality bomb!
I will build a great, great wall.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know.
Change has come to America.
Catapult the propaganda.
From a secure location on top of the ridge in the heart of the beautiful Missouri Ozarks, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Believe it or not, there's a connection between Nikola Tesla and Donald Trump. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a gentleman who's bringing this to light. He's got a short video clip that I will link to in the show notes, both at VFTB.net and at YouTube. If you're watching this will be a static production. This being a Friday, frankly, you don't want to see what I look like on the video today, but it's YouTube.com/Derek Gilbert. He is the author of The Cosmic Conspiracy, a number of other books, and a man who's given a couple of just mind-blowing presentations at the recent Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conferences. But back in 1982, he was working on a documentary film on the life of Nikola Tesla. We'll have him talk about the guest and the topic, which will be our topic of conversation today. It is our honor to welcome back to the program Stan Deo. Stan, good to talk with you again.
Good to be here again, Derek. Thanks for the invite.
Well, you sent me an email a couple of days ago, and I watched the video. It's less than 3 minutes, so it's not a huge time commitment, but it's just fascinating, and there's got to be more to this story, so that's why I invited you to come on the program. You were working on a documentary film on Nikola Tesla, and I would not have expected the guest that you encountered during the filming of this video to be in anyway, you describe, who did you talk to, and what was the subject of the conversation?
Well, in 1982, I still lived in Australia, and a film company, RWB Films, RGB Films, I think it was, over in Queensland, contracted me to be the host of a documentary for television they were going to film on the life of Nikola Tesla. And as part of that, we flew to the States, and we filmed in various cities, and one of them we filmed in was Boston. Now, the guy we met there was Donald Trump's uncle. I know. At the time, it didn't mean anything. It just another Trump. And his name is Professor John George Trump. Now, if you look him up on Wiki or something like that, you'll see that he is quite famous in his own right. And you see why Donald Trump made him his favorite, you know, like his mentor, as a favorite uncle, because he was just so darn smart. He helped develop what's called the Van de Graaff generator, those electrostatic machines that have the big metal ball on the top and a big belt that circles underneath them and generates, you know, millions of volts of electricity for nuclear research and all kinds of stuff. And you can use them in your home, small versions of it. But he was a co-inventor of that with Robert Van de Graaff. Now, and also he handled part of the, or he directed part of the World War II radar effort. So, you know, reasonably clever fellow.
Yeah.
Anyway, my director had already sourced him out and said, look, can we, you know, have a chat with him on Nikola Tesla? So Dr. Trump and I met there at High Voltage Engineering there in Boston, and he took me on a tour through the factory and all the high voltage and transformer equipment they were making at the time. Now, I think he died about 3 years after we did the film in 85.
Right.
And so I got one of the last, you know, interviews with him on the subject. Now, I looked into him once my director said, we want to go see this guy, and found information I'd put in the Cosmic Conspiracy years before was by the same guy about moving charged plates close together and further apart in a vacuum, how you could generate electricity doing that on one of the plates. And I thought, well, that's something we can talk about. So I thought, well, we'll get the Tesla interview part of it away, and they'll ask him about this. Well, it turns out they were both related subjects. But anyway, Professor Trump and I sat across from each other in his office, and I said, can you tell me about what you did for the FBI when Nikola Tesla died? And it was a day or two after Tesla died in 1943 that the FBI rang up Professor Trump and said, look, you're an expert in, you know, high voltage stuff. You know about Nikola Tesla's work. Can you come and help us open up a package he left in his hotel down in the hotel safe? And, you know, Professor Trump said, well, why? I mean, can't you just open it up yourself? He said, no, look, he told the staff never to touch it, that it had the secret to a super weapon in it, and they're afraid it might explode or something.
Dangerous. You go first.
Believe me, that's what they did. He kind of had this wry smile on his face and an Irish twinkle in the eye, and he says, those brave FBI agents, he says, I'll tell you the story. He says, but they waited in the other side of the lobby behind solid marble pillars while I sat there with a thing on the desk in front of the reception desk in front of me and took the risk of getting blown up. And he said, I stood there, the staff put it out there, and then everybody left and left me alone with it there. And there's a picture of that lobby, actually, and where the agents hid on that little video. But he said, I saw that it was a brown paper wrapping around a box of some sort, and it was twine. He said, I took out a knife, and I just gently cut the twine after I searched around to be sure there were no wires connected to it. And the twine fell away, and he said, then there was the brown paper, he said. So I felt all over very carefully for any bumps underneath the brown paper, and just like a smooth, hard surface, so there was nothing there. So he said, well, yeah, I got to know what's in here myself, he said. So I'm going to go ahead and open it up. And he said, I set my jaw and opened up the paper real quick, like a flower, you know, onto the desk. And he said, nothing happened. And staring me in the face was this beautiful hand-rubbed, like wooden chest with brass handles on it and brass latches, fine piece of stuff, whatever it was, but it had a lid on it and latches that I had to open and look inside. And he said, so then I thought, right, I can't see anything or feel anything around the joint of the lid in the box, but I guess I'll just have to flip it open. So he did, again, expecting to get blown up, and nothing happened. So he turned around and he saw what he had there, and he turned to the agent. He says, okay, you can come out now. And I tell you, he grinned several times during that interview about that. He just had to laugh. Anyway, so they come over, and what he's got in front of him is a box with a bunch of things with little black handles on it, can be pulled up out of the box and put back in various places. And he said it was an old decade resistance meter, or like a Wheatstone bridge, or like what today we would call a multimeter to measure resistance and inductance and that kind of stuff. But the secret that they were looking for wasn't there. There was no writing, no drawings. He looked inside of it and took it all apart, and there was nothing in there. There was a secret message about the super weapon that Tesla said that was a secret to. Well, I looked at Dr. Trump, and I said, you know what? I know what the answer is and what the secret is, and I just wanted to see if you'd ever realize it. And he said, well, what's that? And I said, well, the message was the function of that decade resistance box, what it was designed to do. The process here is matching three known, resistances to an unknown that you plug in the unknown side of the box. It's a binary system. You got to balance the two to get the resistance of the one you don't know. And I said that concept was developed by Lord Playfair, and he developed what's called the Playfair binary cipher that was used in World War II and I by the Australians and the British to pass secret message back and forth. But it was using the same concept. That's how the decade resistance box was designed. Hmm. And I said, if you know Tesla's work, you'd have to know that before you'd see the secret of it. The way he did things was to balance two things in one coil capacitor system to two things in another coil capacitor system. And it's called matching impedances. When you do that, you can extract energy or pump energy into a huge field just by matching the impedances, one unknown with the two knowns, I'll get it right in a minute. And he kind of looked at me and he said, you know, I'd never thought about that. And I said, yeah. So we discussed that a bit, and I said, you know, one of the things that I wrote in my book in 78, The Cosmic Conspiracy, was about your research, which was reported in a magazine, a science magazine, where you had done research in a vacuum. He says, oh, the plate test. And I said, yeah. You put two metal plates in a vacuum, and you put a charge on the plates of, let's say, I think it was like 3,000 volts per centimeter, which isn't much. And you measured a physical force between the plates of about 57 ten-thousandths of a pound. Not much, but it was a physical force. Then you raise the voltage 100 times to 30,000, and you notice the pressure between the plates was now a little over half a pound. So then you raise the voltage 100 times more to 3 million volts per centimeter, and the pressure between those plates was 5,750 pounds, you know, nearly 2.5 or 2.25 tons.
Hmm.
And he said, yeah, I remember that. And I said, well, you also went on to say in the article, when you pushed one plate closer or further away to the other plate, that it generated current on the other plate, electricity, converting your mechanical motion of the other plate to electricity. Yeah, he said, that's right, I did. Yeah, I said, well, that's very interesting, because I think we have here a way to look for alternate energy sources from the atmosphere, because he had mentioned something about that in his paper. Anyway, we finished up the interview, and howdy and shook and went home. Now, it was about 2004, which would have been nearly 20 years later, I used what I had learned and discussed with Dr. Trump about Nikola Tesla's work and Trump's work, putting it together with the work of a guy named Dr. T. Henry Moray, M-O-R-A-Y. And I had read, you know, by that time, a lot about Dr. Moray. He died before I could meet him, but I did meet with his son and look at a lot of information he left behind about a device he built and tested many times, which did use something in the atmosphere, an aerial antenna, and it drew electricity out of the air continuously, day and night, at around 10,000 watts of power in a little box that's probably no bigger than two or three bread boxes together.
Hmm.
Now, I did read that Dr. Moray had got it to a point where he could pick it up and the antenna and stuff, roll it all up, and go to Washington to the patent office, and he filed for a patent on this energy conversion device. Well, the patent office said, okay, does it work? And he went outside and plugged it into the dirt, you know, drove his ground stake in and put the antenna up, gave it a little bit of a kickstart with this little magic box he had, and bang, there was 10,000 watts of power going through all these light bulbs.
Hmm.
Well, they said, that's very impressive. Where does the energy come from, Dr. Moray? He said, you know, that's an issue. He says, I don't know where it comes from. Oh, that's sad, they said. If you don't know where you're getting the energy from, we can't give you a patent.
Oh.
Now, Derek, here's a guy sitting here with it working in front of him with enough energy to power a house. And, you know, they say, we can't do it. And they sent him home.
Huh.
The last thing he was known to say before he died was, why wouldn't they help me? Now, you and I can probably read into that, well, okay, that hit the oil industry and various other energy production companies and stuff, their industries. But my argument there on that was, and still is, if they had let him come forward with that, these guys with all the money, gas, gasoline, petroleum, all these power industries could have gathered together and invested in a company to develop what Moray had, because it would take decades to convert all the cars out there from gas over to electricity, all the coal power plants, you know, all that stuff would take decades to transfer. So they would have plenty of time to absorb any losses in their own industry and pick them up in his industry.
Right. They wouldn't go out of business. They would just find a way to control it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that's what they're about. So fine. Why bury it, you know? Anyway, the mystery in Moray's writings was, he said, this energy is not like you tune into a certain frequency. He said, it comes in waves, like the waves of the sea on the shore.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get a king wave, and sometimes you get a bunch of little waves, and sometimes in between. He said, the big king waves that come on, you know, and hit my antenna will produce enough power to run that 10,000 watts for maybe 5 seconds in one pulse. So I thought, why didn't he understand where that was coming from? This irregularity he's talking about is what's called a center wave of the solar wind as it hits our outer atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
It's a charged wind from the sun, and it varies all the time. It comes out in spiral arms from the sun, so there's very intense solar wind periods, and then there's less intense, and then another arm, spiral arm, we pass through as we orbit the sun. But these particles of iron and copper and various other things and protons, they hit the atmosphere at the top out there with such physical force. I mean, these things are, some of them traveling at 1,000,000 miles an hour, so that's appreciable. And they hit the surface of the outer atmosphere and actually cause physical shock waves to go through the entire ionosphere and down into the atmosphere of our planet. Now, Dr. Trump and I talked about the atmosphere. The atmosphere acts like the inside of a simple two-plate capacitor. It acts like the dielectric, which is what stores the mechanical charge in a capacitor. The surface of the Earth is like the other plate, and the ionosphere at the top of the atmosphere, that is the other plate of a two-plate capacitor like he was playing with.
Oh, okay.
So,
right.
So think about it.
Yeah.
These particles are hitting it, and they're moving that outer plate to and away from the surface of the Earth. Small amounts, but all the time, bang, 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 like this, right?
Yeah.
That physical shockwave going through the atmosphere below is something that you can tie into and siphon off as electricity.
Huh.
Now, there's a way to do that, and I'll tell you now, Maury was quite a secretive fellow, and he wanted the patents on this. He wanted to be the new Ford, you know, of the electrical industry.
Sure.
And there's nothing wrong with that. He'd worked on this for 40 years developing it. But when he would show the box and the antenna and the ground stake to people that were, you know, like judges and sheriffs and stuff to testify, he would let them put their hands down inside the box. He took the lid off the bread box size thing, and they could feel any of the components. And all they saw was a series of Tesla step-down coils to step voltages down and frequencies down. And when it was running, you could very carefully put your hand down inside of it, and it was cool. It didn't even get warm putting 10,000 watts of power out.
Wow.
Now, that's a clue. But anyway, to start it, he'd put the lid back on it, and there was a little slot on the side of it where you could put a cigar-sized box into it, and there were two metal rods coming out of that, a very short iron rod. He would take a magnet, and he would stroke it across those two rods. They were close enough together you could touch them both with the magnet, and he'd sweep past it like you were, you know, starting a fire in your fireplace with a spark gun or something. He would sweep past it, and he'd wait, and he'd tune something. No, didn't start. Sweep past it again and tune again until it caught. Now, he would never let them see what was inside the cigar box.
Hmm.
But one time, somebody bumped the table that it was on while he was showing them, and the device stopped running. They'd heard a little tinkling sound like a piece of metal or something falling inside the cigar box. Now, it took a while. I did figure out why and what the process was there, but that was not the secret. The secret was the antenna. Hmm. And it's knowing how to establish a field in that antenna so that it just ties into the atmosphere. Now, if you read my patent application, which is at the end of the video, and I give you a link so you can go to the patent office and see it, you'll see what the patent office did to me when I tried to file a very basic patent for the circuit. And the attorneys had advised me to do that because if you get too specific with it, they can just change a little bit of this and that in the circuit and have a new patent on you.
Right.
So I said, right. Now, you'll go in there and you can see that I filed for the patent. The patent office says, it can't work, so we're not going to grant you a patent. They didn't even give me a chance to prove it.
Hmm.
So normally, the rule at the patent office is a patent application comes in. If it's denied or sent back to be redone or whatever, that original application goes into a locked box into their safe and doesn't come out. You know, it's kept there until after the patent is granted or until it's, abandoned. And what they did with mine is they skipped that step entirely and put it straight up on the internet for all to see.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, which is kind of sad, but I realized that I was dealing with the Chinese desk that had been established by Clinton right there inside the patent office. And I talked to a patent officer there that I got to be friends with, and he said, yeah, look, he said, since they did that, these Chinese have been sitting here just going over everything coming in and stealing it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's what President Trump is talking about. The Chinese are not playing fair, and they, you know, if we, our government, before Mr. Trump came in, was not protecting intellectual property by protecting the patent rights here and preventing others, other countries from making and coming back in and competing against American inventors. As a result, like in my case, I could not go to an investor group and say, look, put up a few million dollars here and we're going to build these things and sell them. What's the guarantee that no one else will go into competition?
Right,
what's your intellectual property guarantee?
Wow.
I said, well, I can't guarantee that because they put it on the internet and, you know, the Chinese have got it, everybody's seen it.
Yeah. You know, well, I've heard similar things about trade shows for specialized equipment, like, you know, mining equipment, where Chinese engineers will basically go from booth to booth with cameras and notepads and basically just copy and measuring tapes and just measuring and photographing everything so that they can go home and engineer cheaper versions of the same equipment being put out there by Australian and English and German and American companies. But I didn't realize they were inside the patent office.
Yeah, they are. And I'll tell you what, the Japanese do the same thing. When I was down in Australia, I was a partner in a business that we developed software, and one of our friends had developed a hardware to computer cut big blocks of styrofoam into pillars or shapes and then coat them with polyurethane and, you know, for use in displays or in other cases in fake waterfalls and things like that inside
right.
shopping centers.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we developed all this. And we had done so in a year's time and turned our business into a very profitable business. And the governor, which is called the premier of West Australia, she awarded us as the lead small business development for the year. And as part of that, she says, and we're going to bring in the Japanese business delegation to be your guest. And we'd ask for you to take care of them for a day and show them, you know, around your factory.
Oops.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, we had them in our office inside the factory, and we just briefly pointed to the cutting machine outside and where the computers connect to it in our office. And some of the stuff we'd made was sitting around in the factory, and they all kind of, you know, half bowed and smiled and grunted. And the caretaker for them that spoke Japanese, this lady came in with them into our office, and we'd been told to give them, you know, Coca-Cola because they like that, but not to be offended because they would drink it down to two fingers depth and then stop so as not to insult their host by saying there wasn't enough. And we talked, and I did a head count while I was explaining various other things to them, and we were short one. I thought, where did that one go? And so I went outside into the factory. My partner took over the talking to them, and I surprised one of them underneath the bed of our cutting table, which was probably 16 feet long and about 5 feet wide. And he had his video camera running underneath it, videotaping underneath how it all worked. And these guys represented a Japanese car manufacturer, and they were looking at using something like this to help in the assembly of their cars. So anyway, he looked like I'd caught him doing something bad, which I had, and stiffened right up and said, restroom. And I said, that's not the restroom. But anyway, they do it. And so the Japanese and the Chinese both steal from Australians and New Zealanders and Americans and others.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad, but that's the way it is.
Yeah,
and it wouldn't be, you wouldn't mind sharing if they were going to give you a kickback for the work you did to develop the product.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, I've actually watched and been involved in catching them in the espionage that way.
Well, I've been in outside sales, and there are a number of companies I went to where they said there were signs at the front desk saying, leave your cameras here at the front desk. And it just, I guess my mind doesn't work that way. But when you've got that much money on the line, it's not hard to understand why people would go to extreme lengths to try to steal the work of others. It is a shame, but there are plenty of folks out there who think that way. I mean, well, Tesla himself was guilty of this. Sharon is researching Tesla now. She's writing a series of novels that begins about where the Ripper murders, Jack the Ripper murders, leave off. And she's just decided to introduce Tesla as a character in one of the later novels. He just sort of appears out of nowhere.
Right.
Yeah, sort of like in the movie The Prestige, where Tesla, played by David Bowie, is a character and he invents a way to basically immediately transport a copy of one of the magicians into another device. And the question is, you know, which one's the original, which one's the copy? But anyway, she's been doing some reading on Tesla and found out that he basically got gypped out of a bonus he was promised by Thomas Edison for developing something that solved a real challenging engineering problem. He was promised
He's
promised like $50,000, and Tesla put his mind to it, worked extra, and he did it and presented it to Edison. And Edison's response was, "Well, I was joking. Can't you tell when an American's telling a joke?"
So, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
It was a rude introduction to the American capitalist system. Mm-hmm. And Edison, never kind of followed along on that. He was shown this alternating current generator that Tesla had invented, which at the time was totally unheard of. Everything was direct current. But Tesla had designed it, and he built it for Mr. Edison. And, thereafter, he left the employ of Edison.
Right.
And he was a competitor to Edison over the years using the Tesla alternating current system, which outstripped Edison just overnight almost and put Edison's direct current generator business out of business. So there was enmity between the two of them, but, for the rest of their lives. But, if Edison had just kind of let his ego go for a minute and listened to what the young Tesla was telling him, we had probably been much further ahead with the two of them going at it together.
Yeah, exactly. And sadly, just another example of a concrete example of, the love of money being the root of all evil.
Yeah.
To somebody who, I'm kind of a fan of science, but I can't, in no way a scientist, but this is, the idea of pulling electricity from the atmosphere using an antenna, just without having to, fire up a generator powered by coal or oil or water, turning a wheel or some sort of work being done. The idea that the atmosphere is doing the work for you by charging the earth and charging the upper atmosphere and then moving them like, the metal plates in Dr. Trump's experiments, it just seems counterintuitive. Why if he had stumbled onto this and then Dr. Morey had developed this, why is this still not in use? Why aren't we seeing this being developed as a source of clean energy? We're talking about clean energy initiatives, and it all seems to deal with giant solar collectors that are frying birds that fly too close to the collection plates.
Yeah.
Why is this not being used?
Well, I don't have an answer for it other than that the industrial complex that could benefit by it may find it too difficult to go to his kind of energy and spend those decades switching infrastructure over to adopt it. You would have thought that, especially in the last two administrations, that this would have been pushed to the forefront as far as their global warming agenda, which is rubbish anyway. But,
right.
Is it because they're reserving it to later when they can control everyone in a global government and that no one can use the power without their permission? They want total control over you? And in physics, and mathematics, in physics, the definition of power is the flow of energy from one place to another. And so absolute power on this planet is the control of energy and the flow of it, because none of us, function without energy flowing from one place to another. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That's why, oil has been, and control of the supply thereof has been so important to geopolitics over the last 100 years.
So you can see that if we had a way, which we do, for the household person that's an electronics guy to make a free energy atmospheric electricity converter like Morey's, that would be a thorn in their side, because you could go off grid and not be subject to the control of the flow of energy on your property.
Right.
Now, they would like to have it, but they want to be able to control everyone's use of it. And the only way to do that is to make all the continents and countries of the world under one global legal power system.
Mm-hmm.
That way, they can say, you can't use power here, you can't go to Europe and use it, you have to have a permit or one of our devices that we monitor to use it. It's illegal otherwise, and they could enforce it then as a global initiative. And they would have complete control of the flow of energy on the planet then. And that's, I think, why they didn't develop it here, because they didn't want it to get away. But that video I've given you there is, to the clever Tesla enthusiast and whatever, is a way to get that energy very quietly and use it yourself.
Mm. Well, that's something that is of interest. Sharon and I, as you may know, we moved out to the Ozarks almost 2 years ago now, and we're living out in the country. I mean, we're for a kid raised from Chicago, it was a real lifestyle change for me because, you know, I'm used to, city services for everything, city trash pickup, city sewer, city water. And now it's okay. We've got our own well. There is no trash pickup, but we've got enough property that if I really need to throw something away, no one will ever know if I just take it out back and, you know, dump it. Not that I do, but I could. And so on. I mean, we're beyond the reach of cable television, which gives you an idea.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I realized that after we signed the papers to buy the house, and it was like, oh, I had a panic attack because that meant no fast internet. But the idea of being able to generate power, if for some reason the electric co-op that we're connected to has a problem, if there's a bad ice storm, like one that hit the Kansas City, well, the general Midwest and the plains, I forget now, 10, 12 years ago, maybe. I know my sister-in-law was in Kansas at the time, and she was without power for a week. If something like that were to happen to us, it would be nice to be able to generate power without having to, on our own. And so being able to
need fuel for it or anything.
Exactly. Because if the power was out in a wide enough area, it wouldn't matter if I could even, you know, get my car to the local gas station because they might not be able to operate their pumps. So having a backup generator, probably helpful in the short term, but if there was a long-term outage, for example, an EMP something else that knocked the grid down for a while, it would be nice to have this kind of access or this kind of ability. How difficult is it for somebody some engineering knowledge to put this together?
Oh, it's it requires only the skill to design and build an interface circuit, which connects the antenna and converts those high frequency pulses and high voltage down to, you know, household frequency and, you know, like 60 or 50 hertz, depending on what country you live in, and at around 120 or 220 volts, like I have in Europe. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, Maury explained that as far as his Tesla step down systems. The trick is to devise a circuit like that that is not subject to EMP damage.
Ah, okay.
But the good point is this. There are other ways to take this high voltage, high frequency energy out of the antenna and run electrostatic generators, for instance, that you can make yourself. These just spin around from the high voltage charge coming off of the antenna. And there you could put a physical or otherwise governor on it to slow it down to usable frequencies for your household devices. Again, you're not, you know, the person that's not into electronics would probably have a little bit of difficulty doing such a thing. And there are certain precautions you need to take to keep from killing yourself from
yeah.
coming down the antenna. Maury, when he demonstrated this, would always have a large rubber mat, and he would wear rubber boots and rubber gloves when he was on the mat handling it to show people. And that tells you right there that there was, and some other experiments he did, mm-hmm. tells you that it was high voltage. And because it's high frequency, I think that it probably may have given a person a tingle if they discharge it through a hand or something. But Tesla proved that you can have high frequency, high voltage strike on your body, which I've done several times in playing with his coils. It kind of wakes you up for the day. But it didn't kill me. And it's because the high frequency does something called skin effect on your body, and it doesn't go down in deep enough to depolarize your heart vagus nerve, and you don't die. Mm-hmm. I've used it in showing how the Tesla coil works in some of the SciTech Museum there in Perth, where I built it for them. I would take my hand and put it on the top of the Tesla coil capacitor ball, mm-hmm. fire it up, and have, you know, half a million to a million volts running through my body and out over through my right hand, and I put a little metal thimble, sewing thimble, on my finger, and I would point at a block of wood that was grounded, and I could catch it on fire from electricity coming out of my fingertip.
Oh, wow.
It didn't hurt me. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And there are problems with Tesla's distribution of power. The way he wanted to do it, you know, like at Wardenclyffe, was to generate the power, broadcast it through the atmosphere and the earth, and people could just build a home receiver and draw power from it. That's not clever, because these high frequencies do affect a number of things, you know, DNA in the body.
Yeah, that's kind of important.
Yeah, and because they were all over the place and could be the frequency could be altered by the terrain and things on it, it just would not have been practical in the long run to broadcast a tower that way. But to make devices that people could, or governments or states could tie into the existing grid, distribution grid, wire grid, that was okay, and that would be safe. The U.S. Navy tried playing with this up in the in North Dakota, I think it was, where they had Project Sanguine, where they were trying to test low-frequency, high-voltage broadcasts to submarines on the other side of the planet.
Right, right.
And so they would charge up this big array with, you know, a Tesla-type high-frequency, high-voltage current. Well, they got complaints from a few of the farmers around the area because weird stuff started to happen. One farmer was up on his metal roof on his barn. He was nailing in sheets of new tin on it. And one afternoon while he was doing that, his body lifted up off of it, floated, and fell off the barn down into the hay. And this happened several times. And one of the other neighbors said, you know, this might be from that Navy experiment out there. So he contacted the Navy about it, and they came out and said, well, yes, it was sure enough. Here's what we'll do for you. Wear this chain link belt, and the chain link goes down to a ground stake in your barnyard, and that'll neutralize the charge, and you can stay up there and fix your roof. Well, that was a good solution. It did work. One of the other farmers who had a real complaint, every time he'd go into his toilet, sparks would jump up from the water and grab him.
That could be
and
a problem.
That was from the Tesla broadcast. So you can see that there were problems that needed to be addressed in that respect.
I'm going to tell the story to my mother because she grew up in North Dakota, but in her era, it was I'm not sure they had a commode with water in it before she left home. It
was
It was the one outside with the little half moon on the door, you know.
I've used a few of those in life.
There are some advantages to low tech.
Actually, I tell a fib. It wasn't North Dakota. It was Wisconsin. I was just checking that. It was in the ELF experiments, Clam Lake, Wisconsin, where they built the Sanguine.
Okay.
It was a Wisconsin type. Well, that would have been up close to where you've been in life, but yeah.
Well, again, you know, technology can be a wonderful thing, but sometimes as those experiments...
It can bite you in the
it
back.
It can bite you in the back, yes. You saw where I was going with that.
I did.
Well, government control over power is something I've talked to Patrick Wood about, and he's a guy who's kind of grasped where all of this is going for many years. He's the author of a book a couple of years ago that I recommend to everybody called Technocracy Rising. And since the 1930s, there have been proposals out there to turn our system of money, our fiat currency, into a carbon currency, essentially dictating how much energy each one of us can use and consume on a monthly basis. And just paying us that way. Of course, getting us off of physical cash, folding money, which is a proposal that has been floated now by some leading economists as a way to eliminate, they say, fluctuations in the economy. And of course, we're told that we shouldn't have physical cash because the only ones who use large denomination bills are terrorists, criminals, drug lords, and tax cheats.
Yeah.
So there are calls out there to begin rolling back the availability of $100 bills here in the U.S. The European Union has already stopped producing 500 euro notes, and they're talking. And there's some economies over there, nations that want to go to a total electronic currency. And if you go to a digital currency, then you can control what people can do because you can't pull the money out of the system because somebody has to keep score, which means bankers will always have full employment and the government can tie your financial worth to whatever they want, whether it's energy consumption or loyalty to the state, social media points or whatever. So it all looks like it's pointing in a general way, at the same end goal, which is a return to a one-world government, taking us back to Babel.
Well, you know, that's interesting because if they control you like that with the digital money, all they got to do is remove your digital money source, like cancel your account.
Right.
And you can't go anywhere, do anything, consume anything. You're broken out there, homeless.
Right. And unless you take the mark, you can't buy or sell anything because the system doesn't recognize you.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the first time I talked about this was in the Cosmic Conspiracy, and a couple years before that, in 1975, when I first started making people aware in Australia where it was, that this global network of the economy was on its way, and that IBM was behind building the systems at that point, which would take credit card purchases and transactions at the end of every day from the entire planet and put it over into a computer they had in Europe, which people have come to call the beast, but I don't know whether it is or not, but certainly that's where they were collecting the data. And that's back, what now, then 42 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken this long for it to get to the point where it could be tomorrow that it happens.
Right. And people will look at comments like the ones we're making here. And you know, 42 years ago might have said, oh, that's just crazy talk. But now we're looking at the technology being so close to making this a reality that finally people are beginning to wake up, and people who were way ahead of the curve like you, Stan, are vindicated, although I would guess this is one of those cases where being vindicated doesn't necessarily feel really good.
You're right. You're right, absolutely. Yeah. And I've said that before myself, that it's a hollow victory.
Yeah. But the prophets of 2,000 years ago and earlier saw this day coming too, and so that, you know, they were even more alone in their prophecies of what was to come. You could just imagine how people hearing the revelation, according to the revelation of John, must have felt in the you know, the first or second century, and how John must have felt being given this message to pass on, or the prophets of the Old Testament. Being a prophet of God, a true prophet of God, is not a way to make yourself popular with the masses.
No, it's not. But, you know, fortunately, I skipped to the end of the book and read the ending,
yes.
And we win in the
That's
end.
Right. Amen to that.
Amen.
We don't know how it's all going to play out, but we do know that the end is coming, and it's going to be a good end. The mission for us now is to get as many of the wounded off the field as we can. Friends, family members, colleagues that have not yet accepted the good news of the salvation offered by Jesus Christ.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Stan, thank you very much for your time today. Where do people go if they want to find out more about your conversation with the Professor John Trump and this
Well, you know, go to our website. Holly updates that. She's been doing the news again full-time since September last year. Standeo.com, S-T-A-N-D-E-Y-O, standeo.com. And you can, as far as that video you're talking about, you can click on a link there, which she has on the website. As you get into the website, you'll see pictures of our books and things and some typing and news, upcoming interviews, that kind of stuff. To the right of that's a YouTube symbol,
mm-hmm.
and it says Rare 1982 Interview there, and you can click on that, and you can listen or view that video from there direct. But I think you will find that all the news she's putting in, you know, in the evenings and early morning, is basically designed for Christians, evangelicals, to see
right.
the fulfillment of prophecy in all the news and what to beware of. And there's light parts to it, like the photo of the day or the comic of the day and meme of the day. There's, you know, that's in orange. You'll see that. And a lot of people go there first to get their laugh or their uplift and in the good news section or whatever. And then they go over to the left of that and look at the key links to articles of news that people should be aware of. And then if they scroll down further down the page, they see it with photos and stuff. Same articles, but illustrated with graphics and photos.
Mm. And you'll also find links to other interviews that Stan has done with other programs, links to articles on preparedness and preparedness products and things. Wonderful treasure trove of information at standao.com. And Stan, again, truly appreciate the work that you do and your time today. And please tell Holly we say hello, and we don't know when we'll see you again, but we look forward to that day.
You bet. Tell Sharon hello for us too. Bye-bye now. Lord bless you.
Check the show notes at vftb.net. That's vftb.net. Or if you're watching this on YouTube, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, you'll find a link to Stan's website below the video. And of course, in the show notes at vftb.net, they'll be right there in the, you know, the notes. vftb.net, of course, also where you've got archives going all the way back to 2009 when we started doing this program. Very first interview was with an author by the name of Frank Creed, writes in a genre called Christian cyberpunk. So we're coming up on 8 years. Is that right? Yeah, 8 years this summer. So anyway, all those archives available there at for you to peruse. Use the search box on the website if you want to search for a particular topic or guest. We've got a number of, we've covered some topics here often enough that just a search for a key search term like UFOs. Or dominionism, or something like that. Divine counsel will get you 3, 4, 5 different interviews on the same topic. And God willing, we'll keep doing these on the rate of 1 per week, uploaded every Sunday when schedule allows. There are times when things get a little busy. Went through a period there a couple of years ago where I kind of lost inspiration, and schedule got a little spotty, but we're feeling fired up now and appreciate you taking the time to put this information into your ear holes, however you, or eye holes, however you happen to do it. We appreciate you taking the time out and making time to let me talk to people with something interesting to say about topics I think are important, and then listen to me blather with my own personal opinion, which is how I got into this mess in the first place, this psychological need to tell you what I think. This has been kind of a strange week. One of the programs I did, daily updates for Skywatch TV this week, I titled World Turned Upside Down, because that's really how this feels. Now, that's not an original title. That was the title, essentially, of the Prophecy Forum conference in Ohio a couple of years ago. But this week, it really struck me again that that is the world in which we're living. We've got anti-fascists acting like fascists. We've got patriots being called unpatriotic. We got a court in California declaring that the president's job description, as outlined in the Constitution, is unconstitutional. Men acting like women, women acting like men, televisions that are watching you instead of the other way around, environmental activists leaving literally tens of tons of toxic waste behind them from a protest to save the environment. It is absolutely insane. Very quickly, to summarize some of these stories, the Refuse Fascism group at Berkeley, this was at Cal Berkeley about a week and a half ago on a Wednesday night. They went on a riot because Breitbart editor Milo Yiannopoulos was going to speak there. He is a gay Jewish immigrant, so you would think that the left would embrace him, but no, because he has gone off the reservation and holds to a conservative worldview, he must be silenced at all costs. You see, progressives are open-minded and tolerant as long as you think and do exactly what they want. And because Milo is his own man, this group went on a rampage at Berkeley. It wasn't a protest. It was a riot. Call it what it is. Like the riots that took place in D.C. on inauguration weekend, they caused tens of thousands of dollars worth of damage in Berkeley on the campus and in the city of Berkeley. But one of the groups that was behind the so-called anti-fascist movement received about $50,000 from a group that was backed, or that is backed by, surprise, George Soros. So, and a group, this group called the, that calls itself Refuse Fascism, openly brags on its website about the use of violence to shut down speech with which it disagrees. So again, anti-fascists acting like brown shirts, progressives now actually defending the use of violence to shut down speech that it disagrees with. This is absolutely insane. because no longer are we living in a land where violence is not how we solve problems. The left is now saying, oh, violence is okay. Violence is an acceptable form of protest. Well, guess what, folks? The conservatives own most of the guns, okay? And I'm not saying that to be flippant or to make any kind of a threat. I do not espouse violence as a means of protest. I think it's wrong. It is not allowed for biblically. As a Christian, I reject the use of violence as a means of protest. However, that does not mean I will stand idly by and let protesters hurt any member of my family or friends. So be careful what you wish for, progressives, because if push comes to shove and the economy tanks, I think conservative America, which makes up a bigger part of the country than you think, are going to have a lot less tolerance for this kind of foolishness that took place at Berkeley less than 2 weeks ago. Another example of the insanity that is guiding the progressive movement at the moment, a candidate for the chairmanship of the Democratic National Committee, Vincent Tolliver, who ran for Congress in Arkansas, was defeated, was kicked out of the race by interim DNC chair Donna Brazile. Why? Because Mr. Tolliver had the audacity to say in an interview, this was an interview with The Hill, which is a publication focused on government in Washington, D.C., told The Hill that he believes that Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota, Democrat from Minnesota, should not become chairman because of his Islamic faith. And the reason he gave was because of Islam's positions on homosexuality, which are pretty clear and, frankly, a lot more extreme than Christianity's position on homosexuality. I mean, look, we're under the new covenant. We don't stone them to death anymore, okay? Everybody's got free will to make their own choices, even choices that are wrong according to Scripture. But having said that, let me remind you and myself, there are none righteous, no, not one. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. So all of us are sinners, okay? God does not grade on a curve. It's pass fail. And on our own merits, we all fail. Now, Mr. Tolliver is a proponent of LGBT rights, and he makes a very interesting point, and it's very logical. Why would we consider electing a Muslim as chair of the Democratic National Committee, considering that I'm not a Democrat, I'm just, you know, putting myself in Mr. Tolliver's place here. Let me ask it this way, because you don't want to give sound bites that people are going to, you know, take out of context. Why would the Democratic Party elect a Muslim as its chairperson, given the Democratic Party's support of LGBTQ rights? It doesn't make any sense. And Mr. Tolliver pointed that out. And for doing so, Donna Brazile, the interim chair of the DNC, called his comments disgusting, that's her word, and kicked him out of the race. So Tolliver is now pledging to sue the DNC, claiming that his First Amendment rights were violated. Well, he may not win on that score, but certainly he should be attracting a lot more attention for the point that he's making. And I'm sorry, gays, lesbians, transgenders. If the DNC is chaired by a Muslim, a religion that criminalizes homosexual activity and transgender activity in many nations that are majority Muslim, and in some places it's a crime punishable by death, why? Why would you remain a Democrat? It makes no sense. But that supports my contention that a lot of what is passing for social justice in America today is really inspired by the principalities, powers, and rulers of spiritual darkness that Paul warned us about. Because the only thing that LGBTQ activists and Muslims have in common, generally speaking, is that they hate Christ. And by extension, Christians. So we've got that. This week, of course, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco refused to grant the White House an injunction against the temporary restraining order that is preventing the White House from implementing his executive order on immigration that would impose a 120-day pause on immigration and then restrict immigration from seven majority Muslim nations. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, surprisingly not, refused to overrule the lower court. They don't really have a constitutional basis for doing so, but I think it's time we just take the blinders off here in America and say that courts are no longer ruling on the basis of what the law says, but on the basis of what the judges want it to be. So Pat Buchanan wrote a good article yesterday, an op-ed piece, saying that it is really beyond past time. It is really past time for the White House to clip the wings of the judiciary, because they've gone way beyond their constitutional mandate. Of course, progressives were all, excited about scoring points against Donald Trump. But look, they really don't have a constitutional leg to stand on. And if this goes to the Supreme Court, the way the court's constituted right now, 4-4 tie probably, assuming that Judge Neil Gorsuch is approved, it would probably go to a 5-4 vote. But, again, if you actually read the Constitution, the president does have the legal authority to do what Mr. Trump did. He may not choose to fight this in court. He may choose to rewrite the executive order to perhaps more narrowly define the goals of his executive order, which maybe would keep it out of court, although I doubt that. But, again, the irony of all of this is the California secession movement is based on the assumption that the federal government has an awful lot of power to make the states do what the federal government wants. And if we were actually adhering to the original model of the Constitution, it wouldn't matter nearly as much who was sitting in the White House, because they wouldn't have the authority to do all of this stuff that the Californians behind the hashtag CalExit movement are afraid President Trump will do. But the immigration pause, probably heading to the Supreme Court. In North Dakota, I told you a couple of weeks ago that the tribes up there who were protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline, or tribe rather, had, of course, they'd attracted a lot of like-minded protesters to try to prevent the completion of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which would move oil from the shale formations in the Bakken formation in western North Dakota to a tank farm in Patoka, Illinois, which I've actually been to, by the way. It's right there on US 50 between Centralia and Vandalia. So the pipeline, I've been to where this pipeline is going to end, or at least that's one of its stopping points, because then from there it would be then transported down to the Gulf. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has given approval for the pipeline again, but the tribe that was at the heart of this protest basically told the rest of the protesters to go away, go home. They had closed down a key bridge that locals needed to get to work, many of them, and to hospital. So it is becoming a danger for locals. But when these people left behind, they gifted the tribe with basically an environmental disaster. Cleanup crews have been working feverishly this past week to try to get the trash picked up before the snow melts and before the area where the protesters were camping floods. And that all of that water then, or all of the trash that's left behind, turns toxic and gets swept up in the river. Cleaning crews are concerned that they may even find dead bodies in this mess that's been left behind. There's an estimate that it will take as many as 250 truckloads to get the material removed from the camp. And again, the irony, the fact that, you know, that this is, you know, just completely turned upside down, is that these protesters were there trying to prevent an environmental catastrophe, and they created one during the protest. Vizio has become the third major television company, or manufacturer, that is, to disclose that it's actually extracting information from our lives without our knowledge or consent. The manufacturer's got to pay over $2 million in a settlement because they were tracking our viewing habits. If you've got a Vizio television, it's possible that you're, especially if it was a smart TV connected to the internet. Anyway, it's not connected to the internet. Obviously, they can't do this. So if you own a Vizio smart TV, let me put it that way, you may well have had your viewing habits tracked by Vizio and then shared with third parties for their analysis. Again, they're paying out $2.2 million in a class action lawsuit to satisfy the 11 million owners whose viewing habits were being watched without their knowledge. Last year, we learned that LG televisions were copying and sharing back with LG servers at LG file names on thumb drives that were inserted into the USB port in the television. You know, a lot of smart TVs these days have a USB port where you can put in a thumb drive with videos or family photos. And the Vizio TVs were, the LG televisions were taking the file names from those devices and sharing it back with servers back home. And then that was being shared with a third party. But it was not just collecting file names from the thumb drives. It was also looking on the home network at other computers and collecting file names and data and sharing that information. So LG got caught at that. And then last year, Samsung, it was disclosed, had to put out in a... It's privacy statement, a disclosure that if you on their voice activated smart TVs, some of the Samsungs now have a voice activation feature, which is becoming all the rage. You saw the commercials during the Super Bowl for the Amazon Echo and for Google Now, its little home device where you say, OK, Google, and it does whatever you want it to do, like Alexa, buy me some flowers or whatever. Samsung TVs. Samsung was warning owners of their voice-activated televisions that they shouldn't say anything in front of the TV that they didn't want sent to a third party via the internet. So the idea that we watch television has now been turned around. You know, it's very Orwellian. Big Brother on the other end of the phone. Oh, we've got a negative Nelly in Sector 12B. Yeah, again, things turned upside down. And at Cambridge, one of the prestigious universities in the UK, a theological college there at Cambridge, has apologized for subverting the teachings of Christ. That's their words. They staged a church service, priests in training, in honor of LGBT History Month. I didn't even know there was an LGBT History Month, which I guess shows how intolerant I am. The church service referred to Jesus as Josie and referred to the Lord, Yahweh, creator of the universe, as Duchess. Well, needless to say, the service had not been cleared with school administrators at the Theological College at Cambridge before it was staged, and the principal of Westcott House at Cambridge told a British newspaper that it was hugely regrettable. Yeah. One final note. Every now and again, a story hits the news about the red heifer. This is something that Orthodox Jews and ultra-Orthodox Jews believe is required for a purification ceremony described in chapter 19 of the book of Numbers. They believe it's a requirement to sanctify the world, sanctify the ground in particular, before the third temple can be built. This would be the temple on the Temple Mount, either at or near the space currently occupied by the Dome of the Rock, which is somewhat problematic. But even though Numbers 19 doesn't specify that the heifer needs to be absolutely perfect, it does have to be without blemish, but the Torah and then the rules that have been added to it over the centuries make it even more difficult to find a red heifer. I mean, we're going on 1900 years now without a red heifer that meets the standard, even one hair of a different color, black or white, disqualifies the heifer from service if it's ever had a yoke placed on it, if it's got any kind of blemish on it, like even an ear tag would disqualify it from service. So we have seen stories over the last few years of candidate here, candidate there, and then a rabbi will come out to examine it. And so far, not one has met the standard. They are now breeding red heifers. The Temple Institute in Israel now breeding red heifers in Israel to try to come up with the heifer that will be needed for this ceremony. But apparently one has been found, they think, in West Virginia. Retired civil engineer in West Virginia discovered this calf among a group of three that his son had purchased. So we shall see. I don't know that it's been examined by a rabbi yet, but it is a candidate, and we shall see what comes of this. Now, again, as Christians, we know that we don't need a third temple, but Bible prophecy, end times prophecy, says that the Antichrist will declare himself God in the temple, which means there will be a temple. It may not be a temple along the lines of the design that was made public by the Temple Institute last year when they published architectural drawings online, even published a 3D virtual tour of what they hope to create. But they could solve the problem by putting up a tabernacle like the one Moses led from Egypt to the Holy Land. And that served as the tabernacle for several hundred years after the conquest and before David began assembling the materials for Solomon to build the temple around the year 975 or thereabouts. So the Israelites were in Israel for a good 400 years without a temple, and God was still there with them. So a temple made of a tent, tabernacle, could suffice. Anyway, prophetically, something like that is coming, and Jews who are expecting the arrival of Messiah, and the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews who are expecting to actually build the temple, looking for this red heifer as part of that process. We shall see where all this leads. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, next week, February 19th, or rather, excuse me, what date are we at? Boy, somehow I lost a whole week there. Yes, February 19th, which is next week, Sunday, Skywatch TV kicks off a four-week series on the two books that we're calling the Cosmic War Package. It is Dr. Michael S. Heiser's new book, Reversing Hermann, and my new book called The Great Inception, Satan's Satan's Psyops from Eden to Armageddon. They're being offered as a special package by Skywatch TV along with a hardcover edition of the Book of Enoch, a DVD featuring 5 hours of presentation, me talking about the subject material of the book, The Great Inception, and 7 hours of audio interviews collected from A View from the Bunker with me and Dr. Michael Heiser going back to 2009, maybe even earlier. One of those interviews might have been from PID Radio. Anyway, it covers everything from UFOs to the Divine Council to his book, The Unseen Realm, and then a new interview on his relatively recent interview about the book Reversing Hermann, but the discussion next week on A View from the Bunker, not part of that set. So you want to make sure you listen to that and then go out and buy the package from Skywatch TV. We discuss his book, Reversing Hermann. That's next Sunday, February 19th. On February 26th, John Reagan talks about the financial state of the union. Three words, it ain't good. John will be one of the other speakers at the Hear the Watchman conference coming up in Dallas, March 31st through April 2nd. This is the first time John has been on this program and had a very interesting and informative one-hour conversation. You'll hear that on February 26th. And March 5th, we keep pushing Preston Condra back. We're trying to get our schedules coordinated so we can have this discussion. Preston Condra is with the Watchman Fellowship, which is an apologetics ministry. And apologetics is something that the church sorely needs more of these days. His new book is called By Which We Are Saved. Preston and his wife Kelly co-authored the book, and it's practical advice on how to share the gospel and to overcome the most common objections, questions that people raise. So a very useful book, and that will be the program on March the 5th. You hear the Watchman Conference, March 31st through April 2nd. God's Great Gathering, the G3 Intelligence Briefing. Pastor Carl Gallup's the most recent addition to the lineup. But the other speakers there, it is going to be a really exciting time. Dr. Michael Lake, Russ Dizdar, Ellie Marzulli, Josh Peck, Pastor Billy Crone, Coach Dave Dobbenmeyer, the host of Caravan to Midnight, John B. Wells, and more. Jake Rahutsky from here at Skywatch TV. He is going to be the surprise of the conference. I predict this right now. When the organizers, Mike Kerr and Jeannie Moore, were here, we did a program for Josh's program on Skywatch TV called Into the Multiverse, and Jake sat in on the panel. And it got to a point where Jake got inspired, and he started preaching. And I was running the audio for that recording session. I looked at Mike and Jeannie, and they kind of looked at each other, and you could see the thought bubbles above their heads. Like, boy, are we glad we invited Jake, because he was on fire and inspired. So if you have not yet made your reservation for the conference, please do so. Hearthewatchman.com. Look for the link at vftb.net. There's a link in the right-hand column. Click that link. That'll take you right to where you need to go in order to get your reservations. And you can save $20 on the registration at checkout by using the promo code SKYWATCH. That's save $20, promo code SKYWATCH, hearthewatchman.com. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, getting into the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, 1 Kings in the Old Testament. We just passed the story of Ahab and Elijah, and in the New Testament, Hebrews, getting into some deep stuff this week about the change in the law that was required because of the change in the priesthood. Jesus was from the tribe of Judah. The priesthood under the Mosaic law was always from the tribe of Levi. Why does that matter? Our weekly Bible study, an hour each in the Old and New Testaments, posted at gilberthouse.org. That's gilberthouse.org every Sunday by midday. We're getting close to the end of the audio version of my novel, The God Conspiracy. Only a couple episodes left. So if you've not started listening to it yet, you'll find all of them in a playlist at the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. Go back and binge listen. Listen to all. I think there are 27 altogether. I think we're up to 25 now. I'll have to check. But anyway, every Monday morning at 9 a.m., a new one rolls out. And speaking of rolling things out, we're running a series of articles, both at Skywatch TV and the website for my new book, TheGreatInception.com. That's TheGreatInception.com. I'm calling this series of articles The Long War Journal. And it is essentially adapted from the book. So you're getting sort of a preview of the book before the book is released. In fact, a big chunk of the book is going to be in these articles. From a business model standpoint, some people might say, are you crazy? You're giving this stuff away. Well, look, as an author, nobody knows who Derek P. Gilbert is. I know that. So this is a way to give people a free taste. Do you like what you're reading? If so, I hope you'll buy the book. Anyway, you'll find that at skywatchtv.com, but it's easier to navigate, and you'll find them all the articles in the series at thegreatinception.com. That's thegreatinception, all one word, .com. We appreciate you taking the time to give us a quick review at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else fine podcasts are sold. And please give us a like at Facebook, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. Which is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. The new opening by DC Good. Thank you, sir. And we thank you for listening. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.